All right, the first case that is on calendar is Theola v. Harley, case number 72487. If the attorneys would state their name for the clerk of the court when they appear, and please introduce any parties or any other attorneys that you have with you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Benjamin Carman on behalf of Respondent Amber Harley, and I'm Molly Lindgren.
Thank you very much, and we thank the pro bono counsel, too, as well, for taking on these types of cases. So, whenever you're ready to proceed, Mr. Olson, would you like any time for rebuttal, and how much, if you would?
I'm going to try to keep 5 minutes for rebuttal, actually.
5 minutes? No. All right. That'll be the order.
I'll hope to come very close.
Thank you.
May it please the court, as I said, I represent the appellant, Mr. Theola, who is appealing from a defense verdict for jury and award of attorney's fees jointly and severally pursuant to NRCP 68 against he and his co-plaintiff, who is not an appellant in this case. As the court knows, the underlying trial involved a traffic accident in Searchlight where the respondent ran a stop sign traveling eastbound on 164, which is the Nipton Road, and struck the vehicle driven by Mr. Theola heading southbound on US 93 on the passenger side where Mr. Gattas was seated. Both the appellant and the passenger were injured and brought claims. The jury rendered a defense verdict, and the court awarded the fees and costs pursuant to NRCP 68 as a sanction under that rule. The district court abused its discretion by awarding attorneys' fees and costs pursuant to 68 without any analysis of the Beatty or particularly including the Brunzell factors. Given the fact that the rule abrogates the American rule and its purpose is to encourage settlement rather than encourage or force people to give up legitimate claims, the Beatty court noted that fairness plays a central role in the rule. Beatty specifically says that awards under the rule as a sanction must be carefully evaluated by the court, and the court must evaluate the four factors in awarding the fees and, quote, make findings based on evidence that the attorney's fees sought are reasonable and justified using the Brunzell factors. I won't go through the factors here. I think the court is familiar with them. The court in Gunderson added that to the extent there's a failure to apply the full applicable legal analysis, the court abuses its discretion. And in this case, the district court provided no findings or analysis of Beatty, the Beatty factors, including the reasonableness of the attorney's fees by application of the Brunzell factors. What the court said only was, quote, the court has considered the factors set forth in Brunzell versus Golden Gate National Bank and finds the requested attorney's fees in the amount of $108,928.50 are reasonable. That's the full extent of it. Did the court consider Mr. Fiola's claim in good faith? Did the court consider the timing of the offer reasonable?
Can I ask you what? Yes. I saw that the offers of judgment were $200,000 and $220,000 respectively from Fiola and Gattas. What were the specials that they were claiming at trial? What were the medical specials?
Your Honor, the specials were in the range of $65,000, I believe.
Was that for Fiola?
Yes.
And then what about
I don't recall
Gattas.
Gattas,
okay.
Honestly.
It was about $65,000. All right.
Yes.
And then the offer of judgment was $200,000. Correct.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry.
So, Mr. Olson, back to your point. You raise a good point. The judge's order is not very good. However, the motion below filed by the defense attorney was 37 pages long, and he went into great detail about the Beatty factors, the Brunzell factors, all the evidence in the case, and the opposition for Mr. Fiola, although pro se, was 3 pages, and he didn't mention anything about Beatty or Brunzell.
Well, let me talk about that.
So can the judge, in essence, incorporate by reference what was already done below?
Your Honor, it's, well, if the court had given any indication that, you know, I've considered these papers and I adopt them, or something to give some sort of hint that there was an analysis performed that we could appeal from, frankly. We might be able to look at what the court did and provide this court with some sort of specific issue to raise. But when there's nothing, I think that's the point of Beatty-Brenzel. You have to go through an analysis and lay out what it is. Because if there's no sort of breakdown, it's a fait accompli. It's a done deal. There's really nothing for the court to look at this level.
But I think the case law is that the record supports it, and the judge at least mentions it. That's in regard to Brenzel, that can be good enough. But let's say there had been more analysis. I mean, where would it have broken down? I mean, how do the Beatty factors not weigh in favor of the defendant in this case?
Well, you know, first of all, let me just mention real quickly, and I will answer your question. Mr. Fiola's opposition on his own was filed because he had to. Mm-hmm. And fairness is an integral part, according to Beatty, of Rule 68. His attorney, who was never withdrawn, by the way, just failed to file an opposition, so he did the best he could. He wouldn't have, I know he's expected to know the law, he wouldn't have raised these issues. But when you look at the attorney's fees spent, I can't say in proportion to in relationship to a defense verdict that they're inherently unreasonable. But, you know, we don't know what the court, what was the court considering? I can't go back and file the opposition, but I can look at the record and say, Judge, what is it that you reviewed? Did you review anything? And the court said it did. I guess I take that at face value.
Right, but Chief Judge Silver just asked about the specials mm-hmm. in this case and the amount of the offer, because the offer seemed fairly reasonable considering the problems that existed in the case.
Well, but his was 65. So they offered him 65,000, which were his medical specials. So, right? Because I'm reading that his medical, you said his medical specials were 65,
yeah, right.
And I'm reading that his actual, the offer of judgment from Hurley was 65.
Yes.
Was 65. So basically they offered his medical.
There's no upside for him.
Right, there's no upside to take that.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, you cannot say it was grossly unreasonable to reject that.
Right, you can't say that. It's not unreasonable.
I don't know if the court made that determination or not. I also don't know whether the court said, you know, having looked at the fact that this is a timely offer of judgment, timing is everything.
Right, but that assumes the specials actually related to injury suffered when causation was that issue, and they may not have because of pre-existing problems.
Well, I mean, that's true. That's not part of what was in the, I mean, I guess there was an argument about that in the motion, but I think at this point, we just simply can't say whether those things were taken into consideration by the court. For example, in some of the cases like Logan, we know that the court looked at the attorney's fees invoices. That's what the court said, even though they weren't in the record. We don't really know what the judge looked at in this case.
Well, I mean, his order is not long, but he says, the court has considered the factors set forth in Brenzel. The court has considered the defendant's memorandum of costs and disbursements, the itemized costs requested, and supporting documentation. He doesn't copy what he viewed in the order, but he says, I looked at these four things, and I reached this conclusion. Why is that not enough?
Well, you know, I think if you look at the cases like Gunderson, say you need to provide an analysis. There is no analysis. That's a, you know, with respect to the court, that's lip service. In any case, I can say, well, you know, we have to say this, so we say we did, and I'm sure the order was drafted by counsel. They can say we reviewed this, but without any sort of breakdown, how do we look at that? How does this court look at that and say the court was wrong about X, Y, and Z? I think that's the point, isn't it, of the analysis. is to say, what is the process that the court went through? And it may be virtually unassailable when the court actually goes through that process and lays out the analysis, but we get the opportunity. And when the court simply says, yes, I looked at these things and it's all okay, you don't have any way to critique that. It's simply a conclusion. That's really what it amounts to.
It's hard to review is what you're saying. The analysis of...
I don't know how you review it. I mean, this court can go back, I guess, and look at the fact there's a lengthy opposition and look at the fact that there were attorneys' invoices that were attached, I guess, and try to do what the district court didn't do. But that's not really this court's job. And I don't know, and you don't know, what the process really was. And otherwise, what's the point of saying you need to provide an analysis?
It was poor. There's no doubt about it. But what do you do as the district court when one side files a 37-page motion and the other side files a 3-page opposition that's not even responsive to what was said in the motion? I mean, aren't they essentially conceding it? Does the judge still have to go through all of the degrees that he normally would have to do when there really isn't anything in opposition?
Your Honor, again, with respect, you have a plaintiff. The court went through a trial with Mr. Fiola and Mr. Gaddis represented by counsel. The court understood when Mr. Fiola had to file something on his own that this was not, something was awry. And even though the participants are expected to comply with the law, to say, considering the fairness that's necessary in applying this rule, to say that you should just treat it as though it's an attorney who filed a bad brief, it isn't right. The court then has to go through it, doesn't it, and analyze what's actually put before it by the plaintiff. Not just conceded, you know, as though it's a default judgment.
Right.
And actually do the analysis.
I see your time is up, but just clarify one thing really fast. We've been talking about attorney's fees. You're not challenging the cost order, though, are you?
We're not challenging the cost order. I think that's on a different grounds they could get those costs in any event. I will just mention briefly, obviously, to the court that we object to the joint several award without any explanation. I'll address that in rebuttal if necessary.
Thank you. We'll put back, because he was asked some questions from Judge Gibbons, I'd like to put 1 minute back on to his time. Thank you. All right.
Morning, Your Honors. Again, this is Benjamin Carmen. I represent the respondent. I'm going to cut to the quick and basically address the issues that were raised during appellant's examination. First, I believe that Your Honor got it spot on. I think that Logan versus Abe says very clearly that you need to simply reference the fact that that the trial court needs to reference the fact that it considered the factors, and that there has to be substantial evidence within the record that would support its decision. And that's the case here. The district court's decision said, quote, it considered the factors set forth in Brunzell versus Golden Gate National Bank, site omitted, and finds the requested attorney's fees in the amount of $108,928.50 are reasonable. You compare that to the order that was affirmed in the Logan versus A case, and that is, quote, analyze the fees pursuant to Beatty versus Thomas and Brunzell, the individual elements of these cases support the discretionary award of fees and costs. It doesn't say anything more than what Judge Israel did when he analyzed our motion.
What about the fact that the district court failed to apportion the different parties' attorney's fees? How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, that's the interesting aspect of the Gunderson holding. The Gunderson holding goes into apportionment as being an option that can be taken by the district court, or it says you can apply them jointly and severally. That's actually straight out of the decision. And here, the district court apportioned them jointly and severally, which makes sense under the circumstances. Here is a situation where we have a defendant who is being awarded fees and costs, not a plaintiff. We have a single defendant who is defending a single action brought by two individual plaintiffs. The cost of defense was the same to defend as against both of them, which was basically a reflective of her damages, the attorney's fees and the costs that she incurred. We have a scenario where there wasn't one person, one of the plaintiffs, who had a partial victory, like maybe being awarded $5,000 or $10,000 by the jury, and the other one getting defensed at trial. Both of them were defensed at trial. And as a result, there's no real way to say that one was more culpable than the other for bringing a less meritorious action.
Why not you know, is it really inextricably entwined when you have very similar, I suppose, with the exception of felony conviction, but you have very similar plaintiffs in that they're both injured or they're claiming injuries. They both have prior car accidents that came out at trial. You have very similar plaintiffs in that case, with, like I said, with the exception of a, I'm talking about, I guess, medical. If you have an expert, that expert is going to spend, say, 100 hours, 50 hours on one to look at the medicals and 50 hours to look at the other. How can you say that this shouldn't be several liability here? Because, I mean, arguably on this, they're very similar as far as medical review.
They're similar in terms of medical review. When you factor in a whole host of other issues that go into the expense of defending the action, they really do become inextricably intertwined. How much time are we supposed to allocate, say, to the preparation of opening versus closing for one plaintiff versus the other? For the amount of time that we spend on direct with our, with the defendant versus one plaintiff versus the other? You know, there's certainly things that could be parsed out, and I agree. You know, you're talking about an expert, and yeah, that's a very, very simple, very straightforward division. But there's a lot of things that are not. And that's why I think that it really is left typically to the discretion of the trial court to make that determination. And it's why they can decide whether or not to do it via apportionment, in which case it's going to have to go through the analysis, or if they're going to do it via joint and several award. And also, too, it looks at the, and now I won't make that argument because I don't think there's any information on the record regarding the finances of either of the plaintiffs. But one of the factors is you take a look at whether or not there's a likelihood of being able to recover as against various parties against whom there's a joint and several award.
Does it make a difference that the case that Mr. Fiola had seems to be a stronger case than the other plaintiff had, and the evidence against the other plaintiff was very substantial to undermine his claim?
From what I've seen, at least in the analysis presented on this issue, I don't believe so. And the reason why is because the source of the harm was the action that was brought. If he had a substantially more meritorious case, something where he probably should have been awarded something, I believe that the jury's verdict would have reflected that.
But didn't your own expert agree that he probably had some merit as to his medical specials?
Certainly.
I thought yours conceded. I thought your own expert conceded that.
I believe he conceded as to whether or not he needed certain treatment. I'm not sure if he apportioned it as to causation. I know the causation was really the key issue during the course of this case. Obviously, there's some issues with damages, but causation was a biggie. And frankly, the existence of it. Liability was never in dispute. I mean, we acknowledge
right.
that. But, you know, when you're looking at the two of them, the cause of the harm, because we're flipping the analysis, the cause of the harm to the defendant is the action of defending this suit. Both of them got defense at trial. And so I don't really see how one was more meritorious than the other, given the fact that they both had the same outcome. When it comes then to...
at least only one of them was in a video, not both of them.
That's true, Your Honor, and we made sure to distinguish that. Of course, I think it was also pretty obvious from the photos that there was one of them in the video and not the other. And that certainly goes to issues as to whether or not...
Why shouldn't a district court judge give a sua sponte, a limiting instruction? It's on that type of evidence.
Well,
I mean, when do you see that? You don't see that every day, this evidence.
Well, Your Honor, I did practice in Los Angeles for a while, so I saw it a fair amount.
Fair enough. But we're in Nevada, and having been a judge, I have not seen this. So I looked at this, and I thought, gosh, you know, it appears they did a motion limit that wasn't really taken until trial. And then you have the judge saying, well, you know, I'm going to let it in depending on what comes out in the testimony. But because it's such strong prejudicial evidence, it's probative, but it's prejudicial, but it's real prejudicial to to his client, real prejudicial. Why not get a limiting instruction?
Your Honor, I would take issue with the notion that's prejudicial to Mr. Fiola. I believe it's strongly prejudicial to Mr. Gattez, the man who is depicted in the video, because he's the one who's engaged in that activity, and he's the one shown doing things that are not consistent with what he claims. I won't go into details.
But you don't think that's not prejudicial to this plaintiff, that his buddy is in pornographic videos?
No.
That's being sent in to the jury?
I don't, Your Honor. And the reason for that is pretty simple. We made it very clear that first we were offering up the evidence of Mr. Gattez's actions, not to embarrass him specifically, but to show that he was incapable of doing what he claimed. Secondly, the fact that Mr. Gattez was in a pornographic video does not mean that Mr. Viola was in a pornographic video. There was nothing in the record where counsel for the defense insinuated that he was. We didn't say that he was a producer. We didn't say that he was in any way on the set. We didn't say that he had anything to do with the pornographic nature of the film. And during the course of both the opening and the closing, which were effectively partially divided between the two different parties, we didn't bring up the video when we were discussing Mr. Fiola's claims. The second thing, Your Honor, is that the case cited by the appellant for the notion that there needs to be a special instruction is wholly inapplicable. The Meek case involves an issue with the use of prior acts evidence. And in fact, it is the type of evidence that you would need to hold a Petrocelli hearing for. So there's going to be specific limitations as to what the jury can use that evidence
for.
Well,
if this isn't a prior bad act, I don't know what is.
It's subsequent.
You tell me.
It's subsequent.
Well, even in the criminal arena, they say prior. We call it prior bad act, but it's truly just bad act evidence. It can be subsequent, too. It still fits wholly exactly like the evidence that goes in Meeks. And what they're talking about is prejudicial evidence of something other than the car accident. Let's bring in something to really prejudice the jury. And the courts, even the Supreme Court has said in Meek, you got to give a limiting instruction because it's so prejudicial to the other side. Why should this be any different?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think that Meek was very limited in its holding. And I think that the Champion case that it was cited to is equally limited. However, even if we were to give a limiting instruction, what would it say? Is it that Mr. Fiola is not Mr. Gattez? He was not involved in the pornographic?
No, a limiting instruction that says you're not to consider, I instruct you not to consider this evidence against Fiola. That's what you're instructed. You give an actual instruction that says you are not to consider that evidence against him. It's only to be considered against Mr. Gattez. It's a very simple instruction. We do it all the time. That's a limiting instruction.
I understand, Your Honor. I also think, though, that when you're taking a look at the nature of what's being depicted in the video, that it's something that would fall within the juror's common knowledge of something that they wouldn't hold against the other plaintiff. This is something where it was clearly Mr. Gattez.
That's almost funny.
I'm sorry.
That's almost funny that you're saying that it wouldn't prejudice the co-plaintiff in this case. I'm sorry. Keep going.
Okay. And secondly, Your Honor, there's all manner of evidence that comes out during the course of a personal injury case. This is not the type of evidence where we're just bringing it up to show that, hey, look, this guy's in porn. This was evidence that was brought up to show, hey, look, this guy's doing things that he claims he can't do. This is a man who claimed he could barely crawl, that he could barely walk, that he could barely move.
Right. What if you had a video of him playing soccer?
Exactly. We would have used a video of him playing soccer. It would have been probably even better because there's even more motion involved in soccer than in what he was doing, arguably. But the point is that soccer would have been great. Soccer would have been ideal. There would have been no other connotations to it. But still, it's damaging evidence as to whether or not Mr. Gattez versus Mr. Fiola was really harmed. And would there be a need for a limiting instruction if we had a video of him playing soccer, of him working in his front yard, of him going to Disneyland and riding a slew of roller coasters? You know, if the analysis is whether or not the jury is going to inadvertently apply video of one plaintiff versus the other that tends to disprove that one plaintiff's damages versus the other, then there would need to be a limiting instruction every time there's a distinction between one of two plaintiffs. And I don't believe that's required under the law, and I don't think that's required.
Of course, they didn't ask for one anyway.
And that's a big issue. There was no request for one at the time during the course of the trial. I believe that the argument is waived at this point, and that's what Meek analyzes, is whether or not you can even address the issue on appeal. Meek was a specific issue where that specific nature of evidence was allowed to be raised, and it was very, very limited in its holding. Okay. It doesn't apply here.
Mr. Carman, could we go back to your very beginning? Most of the argument with Mr. Olson dealt with the Beatty and Brunzell issues, and we've been talking about the other issues too. You were very spot on in your description of the Brunzell and how that can be used and how the Supreme Court has distinguished. If it's in the record, you can use it. But What about Beatty? That requires analysis, and it's not just in the record. So how do we get to that other than he didn't raise it below? And on appeal, he's primarily arguing Brunzell, and Beatty's just mentioned in passing.
It's a good point, Your Honor. And I think that realistically, one way of looking at it would be that you don't get to Brunzell without getting through Beatty. And to the extent that the order doesn't, I will concede fully, the order does not go through the Beatty factors specifically. However, you don't get to Brunzell if you don't go through Beatty. And I believe that the fact that the court went through the Brunzell, well, at least said that it went through the Brunzell factors, that it would have had to have gone through Beatty, analyzed them, and concluded that they would have applied.
Why shouldn't we do a limited remand to make the district court go through what they should go through in every single case? I mean, if you're a party and you're going to take $60,000, $100,000 in fees when you lose, why is it so difficult for the district court to actually go through the factors? It could take you 2 pages to do it.
Yeah, it pretty
and then really have us review it.
For the defense counsel to write 37 pages and go into great detail on everything, and then to get that very short order from the district court, it's like...
I mean, and this would apply to you, too. I mean, if you were the losing side, you would be arguing the same thing. How do we really know that the district court was correct on the Beatty factors in this particular case if they don't actually spell it out?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that that is something that could be analyzed in that fashion. On the other hand, I would also say, too, that the law concerning whether or not there's substantial materials in the record for the to conclude that the trial court had considered the evidence submitted and had made a decision based on that and applied the factors doesn't just apply to the Brunzell factors. If you look at Keyes versus Taylor, that basically says that whenever you have a decision and there's substantial evidence in the record to support that decision, it can make up for a deficient set of findings. And here, Your Honor, I think that this would just basically be a drain on judicial resources to send it back down, have it considered again, maybe go through all of this again if there's some challenge as to the propriety of Mr. Rinaldi's fees, if there's some challenge as to the propriety of the nature of the Rule 68 offers of judgment, as to whether or not they were reasonable under the circumstances.
I think it wouldn't necessarily, Mr. Rinaldi's fees or, you know, under Brunzell, I don't think that's really what we're looking at here.
Right.
But how do we really determine whether or not they should even be given in the first place?
I mean, there's four.
Awarded Beatty, to one party versus the other.
Four Beatty factors. Brunzell deals with the fourth factor. Our decision in Frazier versus Drake in 2015 says you have to have one of the other factors at least before then you get to the fourth factor. But you only need one out of three. And do we just look at the record and say, all right, it's pretty obvious that at least one of them is here?
May I answer, Your Honor?
Yes.
Okay. I would simply say, Your Honor, again, that I would fall back to Pease versus Taylor again. There's a substantial record there. The opposition, as Your Honor noted, was very limited. It was 3 pages. It was filed the day before the court actually even decided the order. I can only say that it considered the materials that were submitted in our substantial and voluminous motion for attorney's fees and costs, and I think the record adequately supports the finding that the offer was reasonable and that it should not have been rejected and that we were entitled to fees and costs. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
I won't spend any time on the Beatty-Brunzell issue except to say that keep in mind that fairness is a critical component for the cases of a Rule 68 analysis. And again, we don't have any Beatty analysis in this case.
Is this a real concern, though? I mean, is the insurance company going to go after Mr. Fiola or the other former plaintiff? I mean, does that happen in the real world?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know what's going to happen. That's the thing. What I can tell you is what could happen based upon this decision. I don't know. I haven't inquired. I know that I'm here pro bono, so I doubt Mr. Fiola has the assets. But something like this could haunt him for a long time. Mm-hmm. So it is important to deal with the issue. As far as the joint and several liability, again, this isn't a derivative claim. You've got two separate of each other. You got two separate claims. You have claims that were, liability wasn't an issue. It's really about these two plaintiffs and their varying degrees of injury. In the case of Mr. Gaddis, as the court pointed out, there was much more to be skeptical of with respect to his injuries. There was merit to Mr. Fiola's injuries, even per the testimony of the expert for the defense. And certainly they were different claims entitled to some kind of analysis. Maybe there was a way to say they should be joint and several, but I don't see that, and I don't know what the court was, whether the court did that analysis at all. We cannot tell from the record. With respect to the
photograph, of course, the judge wasn't asked to do it either.
But Judge, doesn't the case law say that the district court needs to go through this process? I don't think I don't think there is anything in the cases that say if you don't ask for it, you don't get it. It's part of going through the process, and I don't think it's, with respect to the district court, it's not a lot to ask to go through this process. It happens all the time since these cases came down. Even more recently, it's been, in my experience, something that the court goes through. Typically, the prevailing party goes through that analysis for the court in a prepared order, but even if the court does it itself, it's something that the court is expected to do and typically does. With respect to the admission of the photographs, I mean, we've said in the brief they are probably cumulative even as to Mr. Gaddis, but they're irrelevant as to Mr. Fiola. And absolutely unfairly prejudicial.
What about his two prior convictions? He's got an assault with a deadly weapon, possession of controlled substance. I mean, you got all that prejudicial coming in. Is it just one more icing on the cake?
You can't lump prejudice. You can't prejudice Mr. Fiola with the acts of Mr. Gaddis. I mean, that's the thing. And here you have their own brief points out that they had one expert testify about both sets of injuries at the same time and about the photos. It's all mixed into the pot. And to say that they're, on the one hand, divisible claims or indivisible claims for purpose of the award of fees jointly and severally, and to say, well, you know, they're divisible here and it's clear to the jury that they were separated, I don't know how you can possibly say that based upon how this case was presented and the fact they really only had a few witnesses and one of them talked about all these things together. It's also strange to me that even though it may not have been something that went before the jury, but when the attorney's fees motion was presented, the photographs, which the court has, were part of that record. So to say that there wasn't a narrative in which Mr. Fiola was made a part, I think it's just wrong. That's belied by the fact that even going to the court and presenting a request for attorney's fees, these photos, which were completely unnecessary at that stage, the judge had seen even the video, those were presented to the court. It's all part of a process which really, it's inseparable. You cannot separate.
So, counsel, let me ask you this. As your counterpart noted, in this case, the defendant filed a very detailed motion with a bunch of supporting documentation. Your client, and I know that he wasn't your client at the time, filed a three-page response that didn't even bother to contest most of what was in there. And as your opposing counsel noted, he filed it the day before the hearing, so technically it was untimely. The district court could have struck the opposition as untimely and under Local Rule 2.23 said this is an unopposed motion, I granted it in entirety. If it could have done that, then you do agree that would have been within its power to do. If it could have done that, then why are we, what difference does it make if the district court had any grounds at all to reach what the decision did without making any findings at all, which if it had deemed it unopposed under Rule 2.23 could have done, then what's the point of going through all these findings in a motion that was essentially unopposed or could have been easily deemed unopposed?
Well, but Judge, that's the point. It wasn't deemed unopposed. The court at that point had to go through some sort of analysis. And again, there's no excuse for a person appearing on his own without his lawyer. But once the court says, I'm going to consider it, doesn't strike it, then you have to go through that analysis. And perhaps it wasn't raised specifically, the Bunzel factors, all these issues. But the court, I think, is obligated, given the nature of Rule 68, which is, admittedly, it's an abrogation of common law, to look at these and give them important review and provide the analysis to both the party and to this court.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
All right, this case will stand submitted.